The race for seats on the board of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is on. Do you know who's running and who you'll vote for? Well, HPR's Kuvehi Hirishi is here to talk about the challenges of selecting trustees for OHA.
Aloha, Catherine. That's right. These OHA races, Office of Hawaiian Affairs races for the Board of Trustees are plagued with the highest blank votes that come in on the ballots, and also just getting their name out there is a rough thing. So we've got three races on the ballot in November, 10 candidates vying for five seats, Oahu seat, Maui seat, and also three at-large seats. And these seats aren't specific to that constituency. So Oahu seat isn't mainly for Oahu constituents. It's a statewide race. So what I looked at and I thought was really interesting was the Oahu race, which I thought was a great example of how challenging it is to run in these races. So in the primary, 35-year-old newcomer to the field, Kalea Kaka. She's an employee over at Kamehameha Middle School up in Kapalama. She took the race by 5,000 votes. Now, a little experience in the political sphere, but she is the daughter, a granddaughter of our late U.S. Senator Daniel Akaka.
Right, so there's a legacy thing going
there's
on.
There's the legacy thing going on. And so she, I don't know if she didn't really say that she was surprised by it. I think folks were surprised that she was an up-and-comer, but not surprised because she's got the name recognition that can pretty much trump anybody trying to get these seats. So Kale got to meet with her, and she was there with her family. And you would think because she's so young and new that she would bring a more fresh perspective, or that she wants to sort of get this revolutionary change going on. But she's a lot more conservative than we might think. When I asked her about what she thought about sort of changing up the board composition over at OHA, this is what she had to say.
And that's one thing that I really want to exercise at OHA is balance, where we have the wisdom of those who've been in there for many years. We need that. We need that. And also with the balance of having new, fresh perspective come in. And, you know, change is going to happen. It's happening. But let's do this where we make it work for us.
So she hasn't really campaigned a lot. She's been doing a lot of family-oriented activities, events to kind of just be present. But she looks like a strong candidate for the win come November. So she's up against Esther Kia'aina, sort of this vet in policy circles, 25 years of experience up in D.C., here in Hawaii. She also worked for Senator Akaka in the 90s for like 9 years. So the two candidates know each other. And Esther, like I said, came in 5,000 votes behind Akaka in the race in the primaries. So she's been sort of finding any way that she could to get her name out so that people can vote for her and know that she has all this experience.
Yeah, it's interesting because I knew Esther when she lived in Guam.
That's right.
And she also worked in, I think, Congressman Underwood's office in D.C. So she's got a pretty broad background.
She does. She was also instrumental in passage of the 1993 Apology Resolution. She's done a lot, but like I said, the voters, it's hard to get voters to look up these candidates and figure out who could really help the board. So Kia'aina has a lot more of a revolutionary take on, she really wants to change what's going on at the OHA board, and I think that's what really sets them apart, Akaka and Kia'aina. This is Kia'aina on why she decided to run for OHA instead of anything else.
What I have told them is the fact of the matter is we have a dysfunctional board of trustees at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, a $600 million trust that while it has a direct impact on Native Hawaiians, it has an indirect impact on all of the people of Hawaii. I felt that with my skill set, I would be able to help Kokoa. I'm young enough to be able to look at other opportunities in the future, but at the moment, I'm solely focused on helping to improve the manner of how OHA serves our beneficiaries. They have a tremendous opportunity to help the people of Hawaii, and they're not doing that.
That was Kia'aina at one of her rallies where they were doing phone banking on trying to get her name out. But That race should be an interesting one. Every Oahu trustee seat was taken out or was given up by Peter Apole. And so it wasn't an expected race to be on the ballot this year, but it is, and these two candidates are really vying for it. It was an interesting idea about this idea of name recognition in this race. I spoke to Samuel Wilder King II. So he was a candidate in the primary, came in. He didn't make the cutoff, but he was vying against Akaka and Kia'aina for this seat. I asked him about about name recognition because he also has a very strong name recognition. He took Oahu. His grandfather is the first Native Hawaiian governor of the territory. He took Oahu's seat, and this is what he had to say about how important that factor is.
My family name is well known, and I think it's one of the reasons it helped me a lot in the race. I was looking at that as a factor. I mean, I think Akaka is obviously looking at that as a factor. I think it's an interesting thing for Kia'aina because she's been around a lot, but she doesn't have a huge name recognition legacy in the sense that, you know, she has a grandfather that was famous, like Ian Kalei did.
So this factor will play into the votes and the results in the general election. But I think the candidates are hoping that voters will look more into these candidates before they make their choice.
Right. And we do have Rowena Akana, who is in the midst of that Ethics Commission hearing. And she's the veteran. She's been there 28 years, the longest running candidate for OHA.
That's right. She's got that 50 count violation with the Ethics Commission going through contested case hearings. That should go through the end of this week. But I think that the result of that will likely have an impact on voters as well.
All right. Thanks a lot, Kuvei.
Thanks.
We've been talking with HPR's Kuvei Hirishi about the upcoming election of the OHA trustees.
Support for The Conversation comes from PBS Hawaii, presenting Ka Ko, Hawaii's Town Hall, a live community conversation about the future of work and why the workplace as we know it today may not exist, tonight at 8, pbshawaii.org.
Hawaii's Death with Dignity Law is set to go into effect January 1st. The law allows terminally ill patients to request a lethal prescription to voluntarily end their lives. Including Hawaii, there are now 5 states, plus the District of Columbia, that allow medical aid in dying. The nonprofit group Compassionate Choices advocates for improved access to medical aid in dying. Dr. David Grube is a retired family physician and the National Medical Director for Compassionate Choices. He spent his career practicing in Oregon, which was the first state in the nation to allow medical aid in dying. He was in Hawaii to help healthcare professionals navigate what's coming up. He spoke with The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty.
So I practice in a very small town in Oregon, and I've practiced there since 1977. The law in Oregon passed in 1996, but actually took effect in 1997. It wasn't until about 1999 that a first patient who was dying came to me requesting support and help and wanted to consider using the Death with Dignity law. I had no experience in that, although I've taken care of many people that were dying and have been involved in hospice since 1980. This was new to me, so I needed to reach out, and I reached out to a medical director of a hospice, Dr. Cleaver, and he and I met and talked, and he taught me how to respond to the request, to ask questions of the patient about what they really need, what they really want, to make sure that their family knows about their request, and to begin to understand all the complexities and very difficult things that they're going through. So that process happened, and then since that time, over the years, once perhaps or twice a year, a patient might want to talk about this.
And this is something that a lot of doctors have a big ethical problem with, so I imagine it's not really something that's covered in most medical schools, especially since it's not legal in every state. Are young doctors getting experience with how to handle these type of cases?
So I think it goes even deeper than that. I think historically, and this may shock you or may not, but historically doctors haven't been taught much about dying, the dying process, about how to talk about death, end-of-life experiences. So actually nationally, in all states, in all medical schools, this has become a kind of a focus. People are living longer, and it's very complicated to die in America. It doesn't, especially if you're in a health system and you're in the hospital with our wonderful new technologies. So historically, right, there's been no education. However, now in Oregon, both medical schools we have in Oregon teach end-of-life classes, including death with dignity. And schools I know in California, Washington, and Colorado teach end-of-life courses that include medical aid in dying, or as you would have in Hawaii, the Our Care, Our Choice Act.
Well, there are five states across the country, including Hawaii and then also the District of Columbia, that have some type of death with dignity law. Are they fairly uniform, or do they vary from state to state?
Very, very uniform. The Oregon law, which was, as I said, is 21 years old, hasn't been changed a word in all that time. So it's effective and works well. So all the other states modeled their law on the Oregon law. Hawaii's new act is almost the same, a few little differences here and there, but pretty much the same.
And it takes effect January 1st. So that's when patients are eligible to request this type of service. What types of issues have you encountered over your professional career when it comes to actually carrying out these types of requests?
Well, first of all, we need to look at each individual case and make sure that we understand what the patient's values and priorities are, and whether other kinds of things are bothering them, and is this appropriate to even be talking about. But if you go through all that, and particularly if you listen, sit down and listen, each case, each person has a backstory that is different, and we need to address those. I try to make sure every person is involved in hospice and has a hospice nurse and personnel to help them. So I think that's very, very important. And then address their cultural and religious issues, make sure that we understand, those aren't going to be a conflict for them. And, of course, personally, and I think you asked this question and I didn't answer it, we have to look at ourselves and understand if this is aligns with our professional integrity.
Well, and on that line, many doctors do consider this at odds with the Hippocratic Oath that all physicians take. How have you squared those somewhat conflicting ideas in your professional career?
That's a great question. So if you really look at it, no doctor takes the Hippocratic Oath and hasn't for almost 20 years. It's not used in any medical schools anymore. There are new oaths, the Physician's Oath, the Geneva Ethical Code, etc. So that everyone always brings that up, the Hippocratic Oath, but it doesn't really exist. It's not a thing. So the prime issues that you think about, I think, in this regard are patient autonomy. In other words, an intelligent adult has the right to choose to have any treatment or not have that treatment. And beneficence, do good things for people, make sure to help them. Primum non nocere, which means don't do harm, do no harm. And that's also called non-maleficence. And historically, I think we doctors and healthcare professionals have been the ones that have defined harm. But I think we're learning to understand that actually the patient should be the one that defines harm. And if they feel that the treatments they're going through are onerous and their suffering is terrible, that may be harmful. So so I think medical aid in dying aligns with all those things, particularly patient autonomy, beneficence, and non-maleficence.
And now that this procedure is legal in several states, and it has been for a few decades now, if we go back to Oregon's enacting of it, have there been any legal challenges over a particular patient trying to either wanting this and their family member not wanting them to do it, or perhaps vice versa, where family members are pushing a patient to get this done and maybe the patient is hesitant?
So nothing in the latter case, of course, because there's protections in our act in Oregon and in your act that this is volitional. There's voluntariness on the part of the patient. All patients are screened about this. They're also, if they're in hospice, they have a bath aide, a nurse, a chaplain, a social worker who will monitor and watch that there's not coercion. In regard to legal action, there have been individual legal actions here and there, none of which have ever come to fruition. There's never been any doctors who've been disciplined. There's been never ever any evidence of abuse or coercion that's ever been recognized. The one legal case that actually kind of happened was in California a few months ago, where a group asked that it not be legal. It was the judge declared it to be held on hold for a few months until it went to appeal. Now it's in appeal, so it's legal again in California, and that case is still to be determined. But really nothing.
What types of protections exist to make sure that there is no unethical or even illegal behavior going on?
Very, very good question. So first of all, it involves two different doctors. So your own doctor has to determine that you understand what you're requesting, that you are about to die. That's called a terminal illness. That you have volition, and that you can self-ingest. In other words, you have to take the medicine yourself. The doctor doesn't give it to you. Then that you have to go to a second doctor who does the same thing, has to determine all those things. In Hawaii, you have to go to a third provider, and that gets a mental health assessment. We don't have that in other states, but Hawaii has that third protection, if you will, or maybe even becomes a barrier, because these are very, very sick people. And for them to get in to three different providers, and the first provider, you have to get in twice to see them, four different visits are protections. A waiting period in Hawaii, it'll be 20 days. You have to wait 20 days between the time that you first asked and the time that medication could be given to you. And then also written protection, so that you actually have to write out that this is what you want to do and has to be witnessed and signed by two different individuals. So quite a number of protections.
So it sounds like a pretty lengthy process.
It can be very lengthy. And indeed, a number of people request this and don't live to get through to a time where they can determine the last chapter of their story.
A lot of people may better know the issue of death with dignity as medically assisted suicide. And there's been a movement to rebrand that towards death with dignity. Do you think there's a difference between those two terms fundamentally?
Fundamentally, complete difference. I think as a clinician, as a doctor who's taken care of patients for 40 years, I can recognize it entirely differently. A suicidal patient generally has some active mental illness. They may have PTSD, they may have drug addiction, they may have a major depressive disorder. And all people who use aid in dying cannot have an active mental illness. They're ruled out. If they have major depressive disorder, they aren't eligible for medical aid in dying. A suicidal patient acts alone and acts too often in a violent way, with a result that's horrible for everyone. Whereas an aid in dying patient acts with their family, they're together with their loved ones, with their music, with their candles, in a very, almost one could say, spiritual situation. And I think then finally and very importantly is a total difference in the grief reaction of the family, the loved ones, and the doctor after both instances. In a suicidal case, we all wonder what could we have done to have kept this person from having this terrible violent action, and we feel terrible about that. In an aid in dying, we feel sad that the person is gone, but they're no longer suffering, and there's a relief there. And so the grief reaction is normal in aid in dying, and it's totally abnormal in a suicidal case. So I think the language is very, very important.
Something I've always wondered about, David, is when someone chooses to die using this medically prescribed means, How does it affect, say, the cause of death that's listed on their death certificate? How does it affect something like life insurance? Does that vary from state to state, or do we have uniform rules, especially considering many insurance companies are national?
The rules are uniform in all cases. It does not impact life insurance. If a person who's aid in dying does not have any restrictions or lose any contracts or contractual benefits. The death certificate is the terminal illness is written, and I'll kind of give you an example. Let's say a patient has lung cancer. They've been through all the treatments, surgery, radiation. It's not working. They're about to die. They use aid in dying medication. We write on the death certificate, lung cancer. We don't write a medical aid in dying. And there's really no difference, if you will, think about this, between that and someone who's in the ICU and has a breathing tube removed because they're brain dead. They are going to immediately die from the doctor taking out the breathing tube, but we don't put that on the death certificate. We say brain death from motor vehicle accident. So the death certificate has two parts to it. It has some to determine the estate of the individual and the epidemiological data. All the epidemiological data will be available for the Department of Health through the forms that the doctor completes.
That was Dr. David Grube of the nonprofit group Compassion and Choices, who was speaking with HPR's Ryan Finnerty. Honolulu's big ticket train and the latest twists and turns. That's the subject of our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Marcel Honore is on the line with us today. Morning.
Hey, Catherine. Good to be here.
So lots of hand-wringing over the developments yesterday with our rail project.
That's right. We have this ongoing situation with the FTA and the city's new obligations to the project in terms of city dollars that will need to go to it. And this situation just keeps getting trickier and trickier.
So share with our listeners what happened.
So basically what happened is back in September, they might remember, September 21st, the FTA sent this letter to the city and it issued several new ultimatums. And among those, it demanded that the city's first $44 million in city dollars to go to rail, which is significant, that money be, quote, fully committed in the next 60 days. But that raises the question, what does, quote, fully committed mean? So the mayor had asked the FTA for clarification, and yesterday he got his answer. And as things go with this rail news, it wasn't great news for the city. Basically, that $44 million he and Council Chair Ernie Martin learned needs to be in hand and ready to use by November 20th. And that is significant because the city council right now is moving forward with kind of a good faith effort to eventually be able to issue bonds that would be delivered in February. And what the FTA is saying is that's not going to cut it. You guys need to have that money by our deadline in hand, full stop.
Right, because it sounds like they just said there's been too much foot dragging.
Right, right. And the mayor brought that up yesterday. He had a press conference a few hours after this phone conference with the FTA, and he was really, you could tell he was you know, fuming at the council for not bringing forward legislation that had kind of been sitting there for months that would have gotten these bonds moving earlier. He particularly pointed out pointed at Trevor Osawa, who's the council budget chair, saying, look, this legislation has been in Osawa's committee for months and Osawa didn't bring it up. And then when it finally came up in a new committee last week, Osawa actually voted against it. Now, Osawa, meanwhile, is saying, look, I've been trying to find an alternative solution that doesn't involve that measure, which would ultimately mean using property tax dollars. So that's kind of, you've got the pointing of the fingers that we're kind of used to at Honolulu Hale.
Right. I know this makes it more difficult for Osawa because he is up for reelection and he just squeaked by the last go around. So his competition is kind of breathing down his neck.
That's right. It seems to be a very tense time with the election coming up just on November 6th. And he is facing a rematch with Tommy Waters, former state legislator. And Osawa beat Waters by, I believe it was about 40 votes 4 years ago. So he's back again. And so all of this that is coming to a head with the FTA is also happening at a very politically sensitive time.
So what's the next step?
Well, we're also curious about one of the FTA's other ultimatums, which is pretty significant. They're saying you need to have $134 million more on top of the existing rail budget. We believe you need that extra money. And the mayor has swiftly pointed to Hart and said, you guys need to come up with that. And so right now, basically, all eyes are on Hart. They have an updated financial plan, a draft of which should be out imminently, and we should have some answers on that other very significant ultimatum coming from the FTA.
And I know it's a concern about tapping into our real property taxes. That was something that I think the mayor was dead set against. But, it's just tough going.
Tough sledding.
Yeah, so it'd be real interesting to see what happens if they – make cuts and where they come up with this money.
We'll have to see how this plays out.
All right. Thanks so much, Marcel.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was reporter Marcel Henry with today's reality check. To read the full rail story, visit civilbeat.org. What better way to observe All Hallows' Eve than to sit in the dark in the Atherton studio for some spooky stories masterfully told? Jeff Gere and Alton Chung bring out their creepiest, most chilling tales this Halloween night, definitely not for kids. Reserve your seats, if you dare, at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Do you consider yourself a creative and strategic thinker? Do you have a way with words and a love of digital communications? Are you a multitasker and a people person with management experience? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you might be interested in our opening for Director of Marketing and Communications. Find the full job description and application details on the HPR website.
Aging, not for sissies. Some credit screen star Betty Davis for the thought, but it's a subject in the moniker of a humorous theater production that played to a sold-out crowd recently at the Manoa Valley Theater. Now, it's been rebooked at a larger venue at the University of Hawaii Orvis Auditorium for one night next week. The show, a series of monologues, challenges the myth that older adults are over the hill with one foot in the grave. Here's actor Ernest Harada, accompanied by Don Conover, lamenting over something very common with aging. Can you relate?
Midnight, I wake up and I wonder, did I leave the door open with the groceries outside? And where the heck did I leave the keys to the car? I keep looking. They can't be far. Memory, what's become of my memory? I remember the old days. I was sharper back then. If I eat fish and do the crossword every day, will my brain cells grow again?
Aging is not for sissies, revisited with men and music. It's the brainchild of Pratibha Eastwood. She sat down with us this week.
It started way back in 2005 when I wanted to do something meaningful for my 65th birthday. And what I came up with is doing an interview with many women that are 60 to 100 to find out how they handle aging. And so I created a questionnaire, and a bunch of my friends and myself went all over, not just in Hawaii, but in the mainland, in Europe, in Israel, and collected interviews with women, and then pulled them together, highlighted all the juicy parts, and then created stories from it. Some stories were created by some of my friends. A lot of the stories I put together and created a show, put it on for my birthday. It got rave reviews, and people said, you have to take it on the road. So then we turned it into a professional thing.
That's a great idea. I mean, just born out of a birthday idea, I guess. Right. It was a gift to yourself.
Right, it was. It was. And so, lucky for me, Joyce Maltby was excited by it, and then she recommended some actresses, and off we went. And we had quite a few shows from 2006. I think the last one is 2009. And also brought it to a lot of retirement communities in town. We took it to the aging conference in Chicago. I took it to San Miguel de Aliento, Portland, Colorado.
You've been on the road. Busy.
Yeah, it was around with the first only women show. And then it went under for a little bit, but there was continuous requests and interest. And so I approached Joyce again, and we had the brainstorm that since we lost two women from the initial cast, we have room to bring men in, and let's do a show of Aging is Not for Sissies with men. And we were lucky to have Don Conover to do live music as well.
But this theme of adapting to age, I mean, I know what the aches and pains. And
right, that's a part of it for sure. But then there is the wisdom, and then there is the humor, and then there is the resilience, and then there is the compassion, and then there is the caring, and creativity. There's so much that aging allows us to fill our life with that is really not about aging. It's about transforming into another part of our life. And I really look at it as living and contributing, and not just aging. Actually, that's one of my big things, is that aging is kind of like a stereotype, like we have so many of, and it is our show. It is involved in breaking the stereotype and showing vulnerably, honestly, deeply, humorously, who we are and what this is about, and that it is continuing to live. And yes, I mean, growing older starts at age zero. And at every age, there is something that we face.
Right, so it's all about adaptation and, I guess, resiliency.
Exactly.
Kind of like climate change.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And so what's been the most gratifying thing, knowing that it started out as a little birthday gift, a birthday wish, and then it's just kind of transformed to this, you know, wonderful show on the road?
Right. It's amazing to me that it's doing as good as it is, and that it really is needed. It makes sense logically, but it's still very exciting and amazing. I mean, there's 78 million boomers turning 65 this year. So their aging is definitely something that will go through transformation, as every other part has gone through transformation as the boomer arrived, and needs to be addressed and looked at with depth, with humor, with compassion, with understanding, rather than with stereotypes.
Right, so it'll make you smile, take the edge off.
Absolutely. So the feedback we got, people laughed a lot. And the feedback we also got was, it was thought-provoking. It made me go a little deeper. So I can't ask for better, right? Humor and depth.
So what's next, the big screen?
Who knows? We'll see what life brings.
And so the folks that are involved in this production, you said some are the original cast, some are new members. Share with us anything else.
Okay, so the old cast is still here. Joe Pruden, who is a wonderful actress with a lot of awards. Joyce Maltby is a director and an actress, who also is well-known in the community and award-winning. Blossom Hoffman, who is an amazing singer and actress for a lot of years. And myself, the four of us are still there. And then we have Elena Kubo, who wrote a piece and revised the piece for his presentation, who is an actor, and Ernest Harada, who is a wonderful actor and a singer as well, as you heard in the beginning of this interview. And Don Conover, who is playing the piano and bringing it all alive.
So you're just trying to then share the story with a wider audience. You've got a bigger venue.
Right. It's such a relevant topic right now. And there's such a request and a demand for it that it seemed obvious to continue and go bigger. So that's what we've done this time.
Okay. All right. So Monday night, is that right?
Monday night, the 29th of October at 7:30 at Orvis Auditorium. And tickets are not to be bought from Orvis. It is to be bought from Aging Is Not for Sissies dot brownpapertickets.com or by calling 371-1104 and talking to a live person.
Okay. Is there anybody get it at the door at all?
Yes, there is a possibility of getting it at the door, absolutely.
Okay, but a good thing to just kind of call in and check in and
right.
Make sure you've got tickets right. Available.
Right, because in the last shows that we had, they were sold out and people came asking for it when there were no more tickets. So, yeah, it's a good idea to get them ahead of time.
Pratibha Eastwood is the producer of the show and writer of many of the stories. Aging Is Not for Sissies, Revisited with Men and Music, goes on stage next Monday. Showtime is at 7:30. Learn more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Christopher C. Harmon from Hawaii Kai. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Hurricane Lane put a damper on the annual Greek festival last month, but its rescheduling got us to wondering about the history of the community here in the islands. We were glad we did. Honolulu's Peter Kay reminds us of the rich history of the small but hardy band of Greek immigrants that you may not have known about.
The Greeks have an incredibly long and rich history in Hawaii, and actually it dates back to, well, prior to the overthrow, but I think the most interesting part of the Greeks is that actually they were aligned with the monarchy and they were part of the counter-revolutionaries, which was astounding to me to find that out. They came over with whalers just like a lot of other people did, but they actually, it's kind of funny because here's a trivia question. When was the first real Greek festival from Hawaii? The first Greek festival was in 1850 when King Liholiho and Kamehameha V went to Paris and they connected with the Greek prime minister, Spiridon Trikoupis, in Paris, and they partied it up. So that was the first Greek festival. That was the first Hawaii Greek
that's
festival.
That's great.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the Greeks have also, they got actually into a little bit of hot water in Hawaii because they were sort of shunned by the missionaries, which was quite interesting to me because the Greeks are Greek Orthodox. The Orthodox Church is the original Christian church that predates all churches. But anyway, they were kind of shunned by the missionaries. And because they were shunned by the missionaries, they hung out with the monarchy. And because they hung out with the monarchy and because they're Greeks, they held a bunch of parties. And the parties were attended by King David Kalakaua. And it actually pissed off the visitor industry because they were sort of seen as competitors in the entertainment industry. So it's really kind of funny. The Greeks go all the way back.
So the politics is just fascinating.
Oh, my God. And, you know, the here's another part that was amazing to find out. Sanssouci, the hotel, the famous hotel, guess who owned it? A Greek.
No kidding.
Yes, George Lycurgos. And George Lycurgos was part of the armed counter-revolutionaries. He was the one that allowed and encouraged the having guns stored at the hotel for the counter-revolutionary.
Wow.
So these guys all get imprisoned because they fought and, of course, they lost. So George gets imprisoned, and he, of course, his hotel goes bankrupt because he's in jail, etc. He comes out, and where does George go? He goes and he gets into Volcano House on the Big Island. So Volcano House on the Big Island owes itself to George Lycurgos. Now, what's funny is that he has another a cousin. So George does what every Greek does, or most immigrants do. They invite all their families over from Greece. Bunch of Greeks will come over from Sparta, because George was from Sparta. One of the people is Peter Camarinos. Peter Camarinos is a major planner of the insurgency. And in fact, he was quoted as saying, "I will give half that I am worth to see the damn missionary SOBs hung."
Whoa.
Radical guy. Well, what's kind of interesting, one of the cousins of Peter Camarinos is the Anastopoulos family. And to this day, if you go to the Saints Constantine and Helen Greek Orthodox Church in Hawaii, who's sponsoring the Greek festival, if you go into the church, you'll see a plaque. And one of the founders of the church is the Anastopoulos family.
Oh, that's great
history. So the Greek Orthodox Church in Hawaii can trace itself all the way back to pre-revolutionary times or pre-overthrow.
No, I'm familiar with that church because my children's preschool was located right next door.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Still is there to this day.
Yeah.
Come in the kids.
And it's just really just amazing to learn about the Greek history because I learned about it through a tour in Chinatown at the Heritage Center.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, and they talked about how there were a number of Greeks that came over and worked on the plantations.
Yes, exactly. So it's kind of funny, the Greek festival, which is coming up this weekend at Ala Moana Beach Park from noon to 9 p.m., the Greek festival goes all the way back to the 1850s, attended by Hawaiian monarchy. Isn't that cool?
That is great
history. What a great thing. Yeah, it's amazing history.
Gosh, I mean, how large is our community today?
Very, very small. There's a handful of Greeks left. The Greeks, they weren't able to continue the typical sort of immigration pattern, right? What happens with typical, like my mom is Greek immigrant, and when she came over, she was one of the first from her village, and then she brought over the rest of the family from her village. This is in Chicago, and they kind of grew and spread. Here, it kind of got cut off. I don't know whether it was due to the counter-revolutionary part, because a lot of them were exiled, they were imprisoned, and so it really wasn't that easy. I don't think they kind of continued that tradition, and maybe there wasn't a sense of jobs. Anyway, whatever the reason is, there's really not a large Greek immigrant population. There's just a handful of Greek families. I would say, to my personal knowledge, would be maybe a dozen, let's say, you know, traditional Greek-speaking families. There may be more families that have some kind of Greek offspring, but, you know, Greek-speaking first generation or so immigrant families, there's only maybe a dozen at most.
So now, do you remember when you did your first roots trip?
Because my mom is a Greek immigrant, I used to go to the village. The village was called Akladokambos, and, you know, I spoke actually Greek before I spoke English in my family.
I did not know that.
Ξέρω τα ελληνικά και μπορώ να έχω τη γλώσσα με Έλληνες, so no, not a problem.
I didn't understand a single thing you said.
It's all Greek to me, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would go to my parents' village, and I saw an amazing transformation. Back when I was about 10 years old, I went to the village of Akladokambos, and at the time, which is really amazing, they barely had electricity. There were no automobiles in the village. You got around by animals. So my grandfather had a donkey and a horse and a mule, and I remember, you know, going to the farm and doing farm stuff, you know, with old school walking. It was just pretty amazing. They barely had running water. It's really incredible. And to this day, they're, of course, they're modernized. There was one telephone down in the post office that everybody had to make phone calls.
That's great.
Yeah, really amazing.
Greek village.
Yeah.
And so you go back every year? Not every year, but
I've gone back, I would say, maybe probably about half a dozen times over my life. The most recent time is I went back. In fact, I went back in May. I went on a holy pilgrimage. I went to Mount Athos, which is just outside the town of Thessaloniki. And we went to Athos on it's the holiest place in Orthodoxy. It's the highest concentration of monasteries. And I was there for 3 days in a Greek monastery. Quite amazing.
Wow.
Amazing story. Amazing.
Do you know if this history and the connection to the Hawaiian monarchy is well known amongst the Greek community here?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I'm going to guess that it's not, because it's not a subject of sort of legend that we kind of talk about too often. But, you know, I want to thank you for the opportunity to come in to talk to you today, because it kind of drove me to kind of deep dive on this. And I think I'm going to document this and put it up on YouTube or put it up on our webpage, because I think it's an amazing history that Greeks and Hawaiians should know. We have a proud history and a proud alliance with the native Hawaiians, and we're a part of Hawaii's rich history and played an active role in the counter-revolutionary that was part of the overthrow. And that's something that's, you know, not simple, not trivial.
Right. And I know most people are familiar, you know, with the plantation history and, you know, we hear a lot about the, you know, the Japanese, Okinawans, the Chinese, the Filipinos, the Puerto Ricans, but not so much about the Greeks and the Greek history.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. And I was thinking about that as I was reading through it. This, they did not take the let's say the classic role of the migrant of farm workers. They did more of sort of the shopkeepers, the entrepreneurs. There was one of the Greeks that opened up a market in Honolulu. There was, of course, the volcano house in Sanssouci. So they took more of those kind of roles, and they integrated themselves, you know, through the middle class and then tried to kind of rise up through the ranks. But Greeks are traditionally, I mean, they're clearly, they have a farming background. But, you know, if you look at the history of Greek immigrants throughout the United States, they are very entrepreneurial. They're very self-starters, entrepreneurial. In Chicago, it's almost like dogmatic. If you're Greek, it means you own a restaurant. All my uncles own restaurants. I grew up in a restaurant business, you know.
Okay.
Grew up in a bar in Chicago. So I think, you know, if I had to sort of extrapolate without any direct historical data, I'd say that they probably took on more the entrepreneurial role as opposed to the migrant farmer role.
What's your favorite Greek food?
Oh man, I'd have to say that my favorite Greek food is dolmades. Dolmades is rice, rice and spices, sometimes with ground beef, wrapped in grape leaves, and with a little bit of avgolemono sauce. Avgolemono is the egg lemon sauce. I'd say that's like my favorite.
And you make it?
Never, of course not. No, we find it at Costco if we can.
Okay. Well, my favorite is octopus. The closest I've gotten to Greece is a fabulous Greek restaurant in Queens, in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what we did, one thing that's great about the Greek festival is that we have a lot of Greek food that's brought there that you can't get in Hawaii. And the most you can get in Hawaii, if you're lucky, is gyros. And the gyros is... You know, as a Greek, it's like, okay.
Right, I was going to ask you that when you first came over here. What did you think?
Huge disappointment. Like, forget it. It's like, well, coming from Chicago, it's like, you know, we don't have stuffed pizza, so forget it. Nothing else matters. But at the Greek festival, we've got really good gyros. We've got spanakopita, which is the spinach cheese pies. You cannot get there in Hawaii. We've got the Greek sausage, which is lukaniko. It's really good. It sells out really quick. And there's pastries, the amazing Greek pastries. And people wait for the whole year for that. And the hurricane threw us off a bit, but this weekend on the 27th and 28th from noon to 9 p.m., we're going to be at the Macquarie Pavilion, where we've always been every single year, and it is the place to go. So like you, Catherine, who unfortunately you need to go to Greece, but if you okay. haven't gone to Greece, you need to go to the pavilion and hang out with the Greeks. You know, I had one of these great, I got to share this, I had one of these great moments. This one night I was working there, because we do it every year, of course. And I'm walking out, and it's this beautiful Hawaiian night, you know, and there's the moon overhead and like perfect Hawaiian weather. And there's this live Greek music playing, and everybody's dancing, which is great about Greek dancing. Everybody's dancing. There's people eating Greek food. They're having Greek wine, sipping ouzo with families and friends. And I'm like, man, what a great night. What a great, fun, different thing to do. You can't do this anytime else. It's really unique and really awesome. And I was just really fun to kind of see people having so much fun and enjoying themselves.
Yeah,
loved
by the
it.
Light of the moon, yeah. Watching the pond, the water.
Yes,
goes, yeah,
the shimmering
gorgeous.
Of the water with the lights, yep. And the singers. You know, these people from Greek that you know, for folks in Hawaii, you've never really heard a Greek singer. And there she is. And she's beautiful, this beautiful yeah. Greek woman. It's like, wow, it's really cool. It's totally awesome.
My one memory as a kid is in PE. We had a teacher who taught us how to dance.
Oh, Greek dance? Oh, how awesome.
So that was my first introduction to Greek culture.
And Greek dancing is kind of so cool because I contrast it with hula. Hula is a sort of a spiritual performance, right? It's a spiritual cultural performance and has deep meaning and deep sort of roots, but you kind of watch it. Whereas in Greek dancing is interactive. Everybody gets in. It's just, I call this a gigantic lei. Everybody gets in a big, huge circle and, you know, arms locked or holding hands, and we kind of all go around according to some simple steps that are easy to learn. It's really a very, very social thing, and you kind of see it, and you kind of want to jump in and do it, which is what you end up doing, and it's a lot of fun.
Okay, and it's opa.
Opa,
right?
Opa, yasu.
And what does that mean?
You know, I don't know what it means. We just always say it. I guess it means like not like hanaho, but it's like saying, all right, like, okay. Woo, you know, like the old cheer. It's like, opa.
Okay, yeah. All right. Well, I'll see you there on the weekend.
Absolutely. We'll be there. Thanks so much, Catherine.
Okay, thanks so much, Peter K.
Aloha.
That was our friend Peter K. talking about the history of the Greek community in Hawaii and the annual Greek festival that takes place this weekend at McCoy Pavilion.
HPR is honored to present Slack Key Master John Cruz up close and personal in our Atherton studio. Enjoy a special island-style matinee with this Hoku and Grammy winner on Sunday, November 4th. Reserve your seats at hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, Noe Tanigawa sits in for our Friday show and takes us into the weekend art scene. Got something on your mind? Call our talkback line. Record your 2 cents. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, go to our Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.